Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And, you know, one of the most desired substances consumed by humans, and probably a few other species as well, is sugar. It dominates diets and is blamed for everything.
Everything.
Slavery to obesity, and it's really almost addictive. And joining me today to talk about this dark history and checkered past and actually the present situation with sugar is Andy Smith. Andy is no stranger to our studio and to my show. Welcome, Andy. He is a food historian and an author and a writer extraordinaire. He has published, in addition to his dozens of single subject books, he has also written a book on the food of the Civil War and the food of New York, and he's been the editor of the Oxford Companion to American Food and Drink. I'm running out of breath. And an upcoming encyclopedia of the food of New York called Savoring Gotham, which you just told me is coming out about 1st of November?
November hopefully. 2015.
Wow, that's exciting. The food of Savoring Gotham. Well, let's get back to sugar, Andy. You mentioned before we went on the air that you started writing this book a long time ago.
It was the first book I was going to write. I really started in the 1980s, and then I concluded that in order to really write a book on sugar, one would have to look at probably 100,000 different sources that were located in many different places, and I said that was beyond my capability.
And about 8,000 years.
And 8,000, well, no, 10,000 years. 10,000 years, yeah, right. So we're really talking about a lot of history, and something that I really wanted to write a history of the world looking at sugar as a vehicle for doing that. And then Sid Mintz came out with his book,
that's
Sweetness
right.
and Power.
That's right. I was going to mention that. Sid Mintz wrote his Sweetness and Power, which is still the
I tried
the
to convince
book,
him
right?
to take his book off print, but he refuses to do that. So in any case, I arrived at a point of saying I wanted to write a book. And rather than the three-volume master work that I had planned on doing, this is one of the shortest books I've ever written. So
well, this book, Sugar, A Global History, is part of the whole Global History series, of which you are the executive editor of, mm-hmm. the editor of, by Reaction Press. And they're cute little volumes. I mean, they're a lot of work packed into these small, very manageable volumes, and they make a very nice library, concise library of single-topic histories.
We have 52 published, 52. And we have 30 more under contract, and we're still looking for authors.
Yeah, you hear that out there, listeners? Think of something that hasn't been written.
It has to have a good global history, something that's interesting.
Yeah. Tell me, when you and you had obviously a lot of information and packing it all in so that to keep the reader interested, but for me, bring me through a little bit of the history, like going back, like we said, 10,000 years.
Is this where I get to do my three-hour lecture?
You get to do it.
In a brief sense, it originates in New Guinea. It relatively quickly goes both east, south, and north. And so it will go into Polynesia with Polynesians. It will go into the Indian Ocean. It will go into Southeast Asia. And as first evidence that we have of the sugar industry is actually in India. And from India goes to the Middle East, and from the Middle East to the Mediterranean, from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic Islands, and then the Caribbean and Brazil and history of the world. Right
there you
there,
go, right in a there. Nutshell. Yeah. Right. Well, certainly we know, and we know in from modern day history, modern day meaning Greeks and Romans forward, that they knew of sugar. the
Indian
sugar.
They did, right? But only if they went to India. There was no sugar in the Mediterranean at that time. And their one comment, which has been often quoted, but they said, we found that they make this honey from a reed.
Sweetness was always a desirable flavor. Honeys, date honey, agave, well, not
we
agave,
have,
but
we have 10,000 taste buds in our mouth, and every single one have a sweet receptor. And so evolutionary, we are inclined towards anything that's sweet, and it just so happens that sugarcane, which produces sucrose, is the sweetest known natural substance.
There actually were recipes going back to
2,500 years.
Yeah.
There are some recipes. I mean, they're not obviously in cookbooks, but there are ways of preparing sugar and consuming.
And you mean Al-Barak?
Yep.
Included one in his 10th century cookbook from the Persian.
Oh, there are many. The Middle East is has galore with sugar recipes of one sort or another. Yeah.
When we talk about the sugar, we obviously, as I said, honey and making mead from honey, and honey had been around because that was, you know, there it was in people's faces, right in their backyards. But sugar, we're talking cane sugar
mainly. Yeah, but beet sugar too.
Beet sugar then comes
along. It's the same
along,
thing. Sucrose.
But, yeah,
sucrose is the end result, and that's the main.
But the one that really. I guess it generated such controversy in its past and its handling and the production was primarily the cane sugar. Right?
Yes.
What were some of the earliest? I mean, the meanings of sugar changed a lot over time, and the uses of sugar, not the meaning of sugar. I mean, but the when someone said sugar, you know, they would delight or rage over what was happening, and the uses of sugar also change. What were some of the early uses of sugar?
Well, obviously, it depends on where you are and the type of thing you're consuming. But if you're well-to-do in ancient India or in the Middle East or Renaissance Europe, the way you would consume it would be through sugar sculptures. I mean, they made these thousands of sugar sculptures that were at a given dinner or banquet, and the goal was sugar was so important and was so costly that was the way you demonstrated your wealth and your power. So it didn't make any difference. You would eat the sculptures, but it didn't make any difference. You were demonstrating wealth, and that was what you were doing.
Multi-tiered, beautiful, elaborate.
Right. But for most Europeans, the introduction of sugar actually starts through beverages. It's the introduction of coffee and tea and chocolate in the 17th century that will start off and launch sugar not just for the upper class, but for everybody.
What about some of the medicinal uses back in ancient times?
The only use of sugar in ancient Greek and Roman times was actually for medicinal purposes. So the relatively little amount of sugar that entered into the Roman Empire was used to help the medicine go down. So
there is truth in that song.
Yeah,
right?
So I mean, you can look at what they had very bitter herbs that they thought were medicinal, and so most people couldn't consume them. So they added the sugar to it in order to help that and people consume what they thought was medicinal.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that really starts off, and medicinal aspects to it continue all the way through the 16th and 17th century. So it's not a surprise. And that has to do with the humoral system of medicine, which we could do a whole program on.
But the humors, I mean, that dictated so much of the diet and what people would, would
it
be
did.
Told to consume or, you know, wanted to consume. As far as the British Empire.
Yes.
That brings with it a very whole cache of interesting tales and a lot of intrigue. And, of course, you know, between trade and then slavery and taxes, I mean, sugar paid for a lot, and sugar was so inextricably tied to tea as well.
Yes, in fact, the American Revolution is directly tied to sugar and molasses. And what I found, which I knew ahead of time when I started writing the book, but I never put it into context, was the British charged a tax on molasses in 1730. In other words, colonists had to, if they imported molasses from French colonies or from Dutch colonies, they had to pay a tax on it. Nobody complained about taxation without representation in 1730. And the answer is most of the American colonists didn't pay the tax. They engaged in smuggling.
Yeah,
and
right.
So
Can you say Rum Runner? It was even before the
We've
rum.
We called them Founding Fathers, all right? So we have a different name for them here. But many of them were engaged in this. It was a normal thing. It was a normal activity. And the reason is the British sugar interest controlled Parliament, and they were the ones that wanted to guarantee that the North American British colonies only bought molasses or only bought sugar from them. And it just so happened that the French had a restriction. They did not want molasses coming into France because of the brandy industry that said, we don't want this imported here. So they had all this molasses left over, which was 60% less costly than the British island tea, the tax that they had on it with molasses. So virtually everybody engaged in smuggling molasses into particularly New England, but all the colonies at that point. And right. That was a sticking point for the American Revolution.
Well, the British being, you know, the renowned colonists that they were, they relied on their naval fleets to...
Well, that's the difference. When in 1764, when the Sugar Act was passed, that is the one that causes the taxation without representation and will end up with throwing tea into the Boston Harbor and those sort of things. The difference there is when they passed that act, they said, yes, we're going to have a tax. We're going to lower the tax that we had on the earlier act. And then we're going to enforce it. So they sent the British fleet over to the American colonies. And that meant that smuggling didn't stop, but it was much more difficult. And that was a reason on why certainly a lot of revolutionary activity was launched.
There was not just sugar being brought in, but obviously slaves being brought in to produce the sugar. But where were they getting most? Where were the British getting most of their cane from at that time? Do you know?
I mean, virtually all of the cane from that came initially was from Barbados and from other Caribbean islands. And then the British took over Jamaica, and as soon as Jamaica was taken over, then that became a major production point too. So it would have been the British controlled islands in the Caribbean, but most of the time, Brazil was the largest sugar producer throughout most of that time, and Brazil was a Portuguese colony, and they sent their unrefined raw sugar into all sorts of European ports, and so that was a major source of sugar for much of the 200 years of colonial America.
Right. So the production of sugar itself was, you know, after you had this, as you say, the raw.
Yes.
Substance. Then they had to send it someplace to be refined.
Yes. Well, they could have refined it in the New World, but this was what, due to the mercantile theory of government at the time, they didn't really want finished products being made in the colonies. They wanted to do that in the home country. So, and also each home country had a different way that they wanted the sugar prepared. So, the sugar was prepared differently when it went into Amsterdam. I'm sorry if it went here, but that's another side to it. By the way, New York City was a major sugar refining center from colonial times all the way up until almost the 21st century.
So, right. Anyone who's ridden down the FDR
can see the
drive
Domino
the,
Sugar sign
on the East River. You can see the old factory.
I'm delighted to report that the Domino Sugar sign itself is now an historic monument, but
that's
not
right.
necessarily the Domino factory that's
right.
there, which is still up in arms as to what's actually going to happen. But you mentioned slavery, and that's a very important part of the story. Because from the beginning, nobody really wanted to work in sugar plantations. They didn't want to work in the refineries. They didn't want to do the cutting. They didn't want to do the planting and all the rest of the stuff. So slavery really starts with whoever was at war with somebody else, and whoever lost it, the armies ended up, the prisoners ended up as slaves working on sugar plantations. And that was true of the Mediterranean. But then, obviously, when they moved into the Atlantic Islands, they needed a much larger slave base of labor, and that happened to be from sub-Saharan Africa. And the largest number of slaves to come into the New World were there for sugar and not for tobacco and not for cotton, and only later on did those become important.
Right.
So it's a fascinating history that changed the world.
Yeah, kind of gives paints a bleak, dark picture of its past. And now all of a sudden we see that sugar is the new fat.
It's vilified.
It is. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back after a short break.
Music.
You're listening to Jump Rope by the Gingerlys. This is a taste of the past on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Andy Smith, and he has just published a new book called Sugar, A Global History. So new, it's not even on the shelves yet, right?
Yes, if you get a copy today, you can actually go on eBay and sell it for a fortune.
But it will be available.
It should be available in about a week or two.
Yeah, okay. We're talking about sugar and we were talking about slavery. Excuse me. And then, of course, there were all the, we were talking about how sugar now has been vilified. Well, it was back in the Renaissance, it began to be vilified.
And in fact, one of the things that I did learn was in the Renaissance, all the paintings of people, if you note very carefully, none of them have their none of them have their teeth showing. They all have their mouth closed. And the reason was sugar literally destroyed their teeth. And so Queen Elizabeth was particularly known that, and there were a number of people who saw her that wrote about it, that she had black teeth. Mm-hmm. And so I found that fascinating. I never really thought about, well, why weren't they smiling? I thought it would custom or something of that sort, but it really had to do with their teeth. And up until the almost the 20th century, that was a serious problem.
Yeah, they loved their sugar. You know, and particularly in the Renaissance time, I remember years ago doing a paper on you had mentioned sugar sculptures, but the upper class loved their sugar, and they would even make their teacups and their saucers out of sugar. They would have made a set of sugar teacups and saucers. Obviously, it would disintegrate when, you know, if it was not thick enough when the tea was poured in, and they would end up consuming it at the end of their service.
Literally, some banquets had thousands of sculptures, and which people took home if they didn't consume them on the spot. So this was one of the ways of saying, I not only enjoyed the dinner, I've now got this, and I took it home. And they would not have had sugar in their home. Mm. So this was a tremendously positive sort of thing.
Well, we were talking about Sidney Mintz's book, Sweetness and Power, that he wrote years ago. And a story that he tells us is how his mother, who was from Belarus, didn't, when she came to America, didn't like the American sugar cubes because they dissolved too quickly, as she was used to chopping off a chunk from a sugar loaf to drink her tea. You know, you hold the sugar cube between your teeth when you drink your tea. But that brings to mind a question I wanted to ask you, and that was on shipping and production. How was the majority of the sugar, the refined sugar, shipped years ago?
Yes, good question. And there's numerous different answers to that depending on who you read, and each of them have it. The question is, what stage of refining was it at? If it was raw sugar, it would have been more like a Tootsie Roll. You know, it would have been a soft sort of thing, that not white at all, and that would have been dark colored, and that would have been then packed away in large barrels, and that would then be what you would refine, or at least that's one view. The further refining you did, you had no granulated sugar until the late 19th century, so it really would have been a solid, and the question was how solid would it be? lots of evidence suggests that it's rock sugar. I mean, it really is solid. And what you had to do is you had to clip or chip something off of it in order to be able to use it.
Well, so you can imagine that the practice of drinking tea with a little sugar under your tongue or between your teeth.
So, you're really not talking something like today, the sugar cubes that we have or the granulated mm-hmm. sugar. That really is an invention of the late 19th century.
Hmm, interesting. So blocks these sugar loaves. That would be later in the it's not rock sugar, not rock candy.
It would be hard. It's
very
hard. Yeah, and again, you have to use clippers in order to get a piece off. And that was essentially what was transported. And they put it in a cone shape and turned the cone upside down and let whatever liquid would be in there would be seeping out as the ship would go along. I mean, we're talking in some weeks, if not months, in terms of transportation or at least storage.
Well, and that's the other thing you think about. You know, a little dampness can wreak all kinds of havoc on a bag of sugar. So, you know, on what we know as our granulated refined sugar.
So because of this transportation problem, I mean, that was another reason why you refined it at the other end. And so when you refined it, then you put it in whatever shape that people were going to buy. And it isn't until the late 19th century that you had granulated sugar and you had sugar cubes and things that we know, now know and love.
Back to the uses of sugar, and we talked about, you know, early uses, early medicines, and pharmaceuticals have been using sugar forever and ever to coat.
Still do.
Yeah, and still do, right. Yeah. To coat medicines, pills, make them medicine go down. Alcohol.
Yes.
Well, it spawned a whole huge other business.
Yeah, so the problem, as soon as you squeeze the juice out of cane, it will immediately begin to ferment. And so now it's not going to be the spirits that we know and love, but it would be certainly a beer-ish type of beverage. So you either figure out a way to preserve it by putting so much of the sugar together that you won't turn to alcohol, or alternately you convert it into alcohol. So the alcohol industry was certainly encouraged and increased simply because of the sugar cane.
Right.
And molasses is a byproduct of the original production of sugar. So you had this left over, but you can make alcohol out of it, and that's where rum will come from, and many other beverages for that matter.
Right, right. Well, and sugar itself has a preserving quality to it.
Yeah, but you have to have a certain percentage of it together in one place. If you don't have that percentage, then yeast will get in and yeast will convert it into alcohol. So that's one of the reasons on why if you want the sweetener, then you want to make sure that you have a high enough sugar concentration so that it will not convert to alcohol.
Hmm. So,
but if you want to create an alcoholic beverage and you have your molasses, all you got to do is add water. And so you'll end up with a beerish quality.
A beerish rum.
Yeah. So it's not rum that we know of,
right.
But you can get it by engaging in distillation. So.
Well, because people think sometimes of rum and the whole slavery issues around rum as being separate, but it's really not. I mean, it is. That's all part and parcel of
the whole
sugar
rum
industry.
Starts off because of sugar
right.
industry. That's correct. Right. If not, you'd have brandy is the equivalent of rum, but you're in this case using other products like grapes or
distilled
or fruit.
Grapes.
Yeah.
Right. Let's. Why do I have rats written down here? Someone said, even rats were bloated. They liked the taste of sugar.
The studies that have been recently, I think what you're referring to in your notes, the studies that have been recently conducted indicate that rats did become addicted to sugar. And
the addiction, that was
it. It's the addiction. And so the rats, when given normal rat food, refused to eat it and would actually starve before they would eat the rat food as opposed to eating the sugar that they had consumed. So there is a lot of questions as to how addictive that sugar really is. Obviously, it's not like heroin, and it's not like smoking, and it's not like alcohol, but it does have an addictive characteristic to it, and mm-hmm. that's a real concern, and one of the reasons on why a number of medical professionals are arguing that the increase in added sugars to particularly processed food and through cakes and candy and Coke and whatnot, that is the major cause of the obesity crisis in the world today.
Right. Those 33-ounce sugared sodas. That has no place in our diet, or whatever, how many ounces they were.
But it does taste good, doesn't it?
You know, and there's a place for sugar, and, you know, occasional sugar, you know, a little bit here and there, a celebration, but, you know, not the amounts of sugar that you can see some people consuming.
It's not just the sugar that you know you're consuming, it's the sugar that you
don't
know.
That's right, the hidden sugars.
I shouldn't have been shocked at it, but, you know, I like, I hate to say it, but I like French fries. When I started looking at the description on the French fries, it has sugar on it. And you start looking at all of the things that you don't think have sugar in them, and in fact they do. And one of the things the companies do...
It's not the potato starch converting to sugar?
No, it's an added sugar on the outside to it, which gives it a flavor that you don't even notice. I mean, you don't even physiologically notice, but your brain does.
Mm.
And so...
I'm addicted to French fries.
It's salt, fat, and sugar. And
the good things.
And the bliss point is there. And right. So, I mean, the goal of any food processor is to create the right balance between those three things, independent of whatever else they have in it and whatever other taste qualities it may have.
Well, the fast food market certainly is aware of all that, because all the studies show it isn't just
fast food. It's the cereal industry. I mean, you start going, it's the bread industry. I mean, you start going down all of the things that have it, and companies are wise to that, and they now have several different names of sugar so that it doesn't look like it's the number one ingredient, which it is. One cereal.
Sucralose, grog.
I stopped at 50 names that were legally used to refer to sugar, and it isn't necessarily a sucrose, but it is other sugars, that lots of other sugars are out there.
Well, the sugar industry loves that. Just back to the British sugar barons and all.
Yeah.
The taxes alone on the sugar supported their whole naval fleet. I mean, it was. On just sugar. I mean, forget the tea. You know, that was the sugar industry. We can't blame them, because we liked it and we wanted it, and it was supply and it was demand for, you know, for the product. But they knew they were onto a good thing. Tell me about the democratization of sugar. What do we mean by that?
Until about the late 18th century, early 19th century, I mean, it was a upper class treat. I mean, that you only could afford to buy it, or anybody would want to expend money on buying a sugary product would have to have a lot of money. So it is the introduction of tea. It is the introduction of coffee that introduces sugar to the lower class. And as soon as the price of sugar drops, as soon as you end slavery, which was another thing that I found shocking, Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, came along and said, slavery is totally inefficient, it's useless, and it is causing not only social problems on the slave side to it, but it is causing economic issues because they're not innovating and creating. And as soon as they ended slavery, you had huge technological improvements in the sugar-making process, so that when slavery ended, the price of sugar dropped dramatically.
Hmm.
So as soon as the price of sugar dropped dramatically in the mid-19th century, then virtually anybody could afford it, and that was one of the luxuries that anybody, regardless of how poor you were, you could still consume something that had sugar in it.
Right.
And it might be just for coffee or tea, or it might be for a treat, or it might be for candy. And then candy production came along, and it's penny candy. We're not talking expensive candy
right,
at all.
Right.
So it really became the pleasure of virtually everybody that had access to it.
And really, until the 20th century, people weren't really sure of, I mean, there was, nutritional studies were so vague. I mean, a lot of people thought there was nutritional value in
There is nutritional
sugar
value.
I'm
sorry
well.
To say. It's calories.
Now, calories.
Today, calories sound bad to us, but up until the mid-20th century, I mean, the problem for the large number of people throughout the world, and many people today, is they're not consuming enough calories. So for those of us that are no longer getting the exercise that our ancestors and grandparents might have had, and those of us that are consuming too many calories, that's a problem that creates obesity. But for many people, calories is an important part of nutrition. So the part of the problem also is that if you're consuming calories in terms of sugar, you're not consuming other calories that will have a lot of other nutrients and nutritional components to it. And so that is the arguments that currently
right,
are
so
underway.
We tell our children, don't spoil your appetite, right? Don't consume those calories beforehand. We did not. We mentioned briefly beet sugar, but going yeah. back to that, so that is another source of sugar, and that in itself is a large industry. Where are the majority of the beets that we know of is the beet that we use the beet sugar? What is the beet sugar used for mostly today?
It's exactly the same thing as sucrose is sucrose is sucrose. It doesn't make any difference where it comes from. So it's used for the exact same purposes that you have refined sugar cane. So it is in the end product. It is more expensive. It is, and it really is there because of political choices that countries have made, including the United States. And one of the things that we want to do is protect our sugar beet growers in the West, and that's a political decision that Congress makes. So we have quotas on imported sugar. We place tariffs on imported sugar, and it makes it possible for farmers to grow sugar beets, even though the sugar beets cost more to process and create the sugar coming out the other end than it does from sugar cane.
Mm-hmm. Give an example of where we see the most beet sugar being used commercially. Can you know? I mean, I saw a wonderful documentary one time on the beet growers actually in Michigan and not even in the West. But it was fascinating to watch the process. And going to the store, you rarely see, you know, if you look at the bag, it says 100% cane sugar. I guess if the bag said beet sugar, it would catch my eye. But
I don't know.
I'm going to have to be a little bit more.
I'm going to have to go check that. As far as I know, from a chemical standpoint, there's no difference in it. Now,
it may be used in industry.
It may be that there are impurities that they intentionally leave in the beet sugar that will give it a different flavor or different taste. I don't know for sure.
Hmm. Well, it's all as we can tell. I mean, we could go on talking about the various. Plots and histories involved around this food substance.
Yes, but the interesting thing is the current political shift that's underway. Cuba was by far the largest supplier of sugar to the United States.
What's going to happen now?
If trade barriers are removed, the sugar cane industry in Cuba will thrive, and if given total free trade, would run the sugar beet growers and the sugar cane growers in Florida out of business. Mm. So, I mean, it's a much better place from a weather and climate standpoint to grow cane. And so if that happens, then a result will be political.
Hmm. Interesting. It's interesting that another book that has just been released or was just being released at the same time as your book is one that you also were a contributor to, and that's the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets.
Right. I just received my copy 2 days ago, so I've been thumbing through it and saying, oh, I didn't know that.
Edited by Dara Goldstein, who's been on our show before, and associate editor Michael Crandall. Who's been a frequent guest here. And Forward, that was written by none other than Sidney Mintz. And it's an interesting book. I've just been able to glance at it briefly at the food book fair the other weekend. And telling a bit of the history, not as the concise, you know, in-depth histories that you are going through, but gives the historical context here and there and lots of recipes and uses of sugar in countries around the world, which is a wonderful compendium of sugar and sweets.
It's a great
to
book.
Be found.
It's a book that I'm absolutely delighted to have made a contribution to, but I've also learned so much. I thought I knew a lot about sugar until I started reading some of the articles.
Which just goes to point, once again, up to the fact that there is so much to know and learn about sugar and then what, you know, the effects that it has.
You can spend a lifetime. It's a lifetime.
Well, you've been working on this a long time.
More than 35 years now.
Well, it's not fats anymore. That we can go ahead and eat the butter and the bacon, but don't eat the sugar. That's what they're telling us now,
right? Don't eat the added
don't
sugar.
Don't eat the added sugar.
There's a difference,
And have your birthday cake and enjoy it.
Right? Yes. I like birthday cake.
Andy, thank you so much, as always. It's been a pleasure talking to you here on A Taste of the Past. And again, Andy's new book is called Sugar, A Global History. And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. Please tune in again.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.